So we are in Perek Yudalet, chapter 14, and I want to make a run on finishing the Perek if we can. We are dealing with the riddle which goes bad. We've already seen what the riddle is, right? We also know what the answer is, because we read the answer before we read the question. But he said, from the eater came the food, and from the bold or the strong came the sweet. And they can't figure it out, and they get his wife to teach to tell them the answer. We had three different views about how exactly this played out, whether this was a riddle given to them in the beginning of the party, but they couldn't figure it out a few days in, and then they waited until day seven to go to her. Which was very confusing to us until we took a Barbanel's approach that there were actually a two-week party. Was actually what was going on. So they were waiting until day seven, which was the end of the prep period, but the beginning of the week of the Mishnah. That was one way to look at it. Another way to look at it was that they tried for a few days, and then it was Shabbos, and they came to her on Shabbos, Shimshon not being around that day. Or, alternatively, that they tried to figure it out for 3 days, and they came to her after that, but she cried for 7 days because she was crying and trying to figure it out even before they came to her about it. We gave all these different approaches and calendars and all well and good, but now we need to see what happens when they come to him with the answer to the riddle. So pasuk tesvav, sentence 15. Vayi bayom hashvi'i. It was on day 7. And they said to her, seduce your husband, get him to tell us the riddle. And if not, we're going to burn down your house, you and your family. Did you bring us here in order for him to get our property? She cries to him, or she cries about him. You hate me, you don't love me at all. You told a riddle to my people, but you didn't say it to me. He said, I didn't tell it to my parents. I should tell it to you. As we said, she cries for the 7 days of the party. Part of why Abarbanel believes that there are two different units of 7 days. These are the 7 days of the party. And on day seven, he's had enough already. He tells her. And she runs and tells her countrymen. So the people of the town tell him on day seven, just before the sun sets. And I'm going to come back to that word hacharsa. That's a very important word. But they on day seven, as the sun is setting, they say to him, Mama sok midvash, what is sweeter than honey? Uma az me'ari, what is stronger than a lion? Vayomer lohem, so he says back to them, ha, you think I'm just a muscle-bound guy. Lulei harashem beglasi lo mitzasem chidasi. I know what you're up to. If you had not plowed with my calf, you would not have found my riddle. Vatislach alav ruach Hashem. Vatislach is a word that we find quite a bit with an experience of nevuah, or at least divine inspiration. The Spirit of God is upon him. Vayered Ashkelon. He goes down to Ashkelon. Vayach mehem shloshim ish. He kills. When he says vayach, he struck, you know that it means he kills. He kills 30 men. Vayikach es chalit sosam. And he takes their stuff, their clothing, whatever it is that they have, and he gave their clothing to the people who had answered the riddle. You want 30 changes of clothing? Fine, here's 30 changes of clothing. Hand-me-downs, but, you know, they're good. A little blood on them. He's very angry, and he goes back to his father's house. And Shimshon's wife goes to somebody else. Goes to literally his friend, presumably it means, and Professor Elitzur in the Dan Mikra says it means one of the people from the 30. So one of these guys who had been part of the entourage at the wedding actually ends up being the guy who ends up with Shimshon's wife. Clear? Okay. So what's strange over here? What needs discussion? There are some things here that need explanation, right?
Why did he kill 30 strangers?
Okay.
Why did he kill the 30 men that tricked him? Why didn't he kill his wife?
Mm-hmm. Why didn't he kill his wife? It's an interesting question. What else?
Why did he divorce her?
Did he divorce her?
When she says, but he hates Shimshon the Merayehu.
Yeah.
The translation I see is Samson's wife then married one of those who had been his wedding companions.
Yeah, and to make that more simple, if you jump ahead to chapter 15, right, look in Perek Tesvav, Pasuk Aleph, Pasuk Beis, you see that Shimshon decides he misses her, and he comes back for her, and the father says, you hated her, I let her marry your friend. But don't worry, she has a sister, which is one of the classic lines in Tanakh. Like, I gave away your wife, but don't worry, she has a sister. But yes, the answer is there's some kind of disruption of the marriage. What exactly the rituals would have been among the Plishtim, I don't know. Her father thinks they're divorced. Shimshon does not think they're necessarily divorced. Shimshon thinks he can come back. Sorry?
Was there any consummation? It's unclear.
You had a week.
Yeah.
I would expect so. And, I mean, the line, Patias Yisheich, is part of that as well, telling him to seduce her. But what about the solution to the riddle? Did they solve the riddle?
Not fully, just part of it.
Right. They only solved part of it, and they also did it in this, like, Jeopardy way.
Yeah, they asked them questions.
Right? What is stronger than a lion? What is sweeter than honey? It's not really a solution to the riddle. And the whole thing is strange. The whole story is very odd. So, a few things here. First of all, something very interesting in the way that she approaches Shimshon to tell her the answer to the riddle. Look at Pasuk Tet Zayin. How does she describe the Plishtim? B'nei Ami, my countrymen, these are my people, right? The Plishtim are my people. You think of the classic way we look at conversion, right, from Rus, Ameich Ami, your nation is my nation. And here, my nation is actually the Plishtim. If this woman has converted, it sure doesn't seem to have taken. She still looks at the Plishtim as her people. Rabbi Yosef Gabriel Bechhofer in his Big Day Sheish points that out. But not only that, the Malbim says she's an overachiever. Because what did they ask her to say? What did they ask her to do?
Just to find out the riddle.
No, that's not what they asked her for. Look carefully. What did they ask her to do? Yeah, and?
And get him to tell us the riddle.
Yeah! Get him to tell us what the riddle is. In other words, get him to drop the riddle was all they were asking for. They didn't ask for the answer. Why not? Look at Malbim on your source sheet. Malbim says, Lo shalomi menashit tegal elehem achida. They didn't ask her to tell them what the answer is. Shalom tashiv lahem, because then she would answer, V'chi agrom shehite nishi lachem shloshim chalivos begadim. Should I cause my husband to lose 30 changes of clothing? Rak b'kshu tetev shiagil lehem is achida. They want the riddle dropped. It didn't dawn on them that she would actually give them the answers that they could get money off of her husband. They're shocked. They're like, we never expected all of that. She went above and beyond, giving them the answer to the riddle.
It's not really.
And he will tell us.
He will tell us the riddle. It doesn't mean that we'll annul the riddle or something.
Well, if he gives them the answer, then that's what he's doing, no?
Yeah. So did they want her to do that?
They wanted him. No, they wanted her to convince Shimshon to just tell them the answer and drop the game.
So nobody gives nobody chalifah.
Exactly. They just wanted him to let them out. That's what they're looking for. So she surprises them. Right? Yeah. Sorry?
The default is that they give him the 30 chalifah, right? In other words,
yeah. They just want to come out neutral. That's all they're looking for.
Yes.
She shocks them by giving them the answer.
Yes.
And the way they word their response is meant to show just how surprised they are. They didn't think they were going to solve the riddle at all. Now they're in a bind. Because they're worried that if they tell Shimshon the answer, then Shimshon's going to know how they got the solution. So Abarbanel says that's why they do this set of question thing. They're trying to pretend they don't have the answer. If you look at number two, Abarbanel, Lo ratzu lashiv beferish mefursam ad she'evin Shimshon she'ishto gilahu alayhem. They don't want to give the answer in such an obvious way, such that Shimshon will understand that his wife has given him the answer. Gilahu alayhem. V'ishtadlu lahashiv ba'ofen she'yachshav Shimshon she'hem me'atzmam naflu bo. So they try to pretend as though we just lucked out. He talked about something strong. He talked about something sweet. Well, lions and honey, maybe something like that. They asked, as though they're asking a question. What is sweeter than honey anyway? That's Abarbanel's read. So Shimshon goes off and kills 30 plishtim. But as Chuck noted, he doesn't kill 30 plishtim locally, the 30 people who had been taken to the party. Instead, he goes off and kills 30 plishtim somewhere else. Right? In Ashkelon instead. He doesn't do this locally. So why not kill the 30 people who are right there, who have participated in the betrayal? So you could give one answer, that it's because the 30 people at the party are her family's friends. And again, Shimshon doesn't think that he's breaking with her family. So he's not going to kill them. He'll kill 30 others. That's one way to look at it. Professor Elitzur, though, throws in an added note, which is that he goes to Ashkelon. Right? That was what we had said? I hope that's still true. He goes to Ashkelon. Ashkelon is deep in enemy territory. It's in Plishti territory, as opposed to Timna, which is among the Jews as well. It's some kind of a hybrid population. Ashkelon is one of the five classic Plishti cities. Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, Gath, and Aza are your five Pentapolis cities. Although not consistently through history, there's some shift, but it doesn't matter for our purposes. The point is that Professor Elitzur says Shimshon is going to go to Ashkelon to protect the Jews from reprisal. And this is a theme we're going to see in his battles with the Plishtim. He always insulates the Jews from involvement. He's a loner. Everything he does in Philistine territory, and he does it as a guy acting alone. He never has anybody else with him. There isn't even an armor bearer with Shimshon. There's no armor. But Shimshon is off doing his own thing, and it provides what today would be called plausible deniability for the rest of the Jews. Ooh, Shimshon, we don't know anything about it. That's the idea. By the way, Radak notes that Shimshon didn't actually fulfill the bet. right? It says that he was going to give them the siddinim, sheets. It wasn't just supposed to be jackets. So he says, yeah, because they cheated. So Shimshon says, I'm going to give you something, but I'm not giving you everything. Okay.
Why did he feel he had to protect them from Bnei Yisrael from Ashkelon?
No, he has to protect the Bnei Yisrael from the Plishtim at all. He has to keep the Jews from being seen as his accomplices. That's the idea. So he goes off in deep into Plishti territory, and he attacks them on his own. So there's less of a vulnerability for the rest of the for the rest of the Jews. That seems to be the idea.
Was this a direction from God, as opposed to Shimshon's own idea? Was it God who gripped him and directed him?
So this goes back to the question of what it means when we talk about Ruach Hashem and Vititzlevat Hitzlach Alav Ruach Hashem. And it's something that we encounter over and over and over again in Nevi'im Rishonim. We've seen it in you know, Ruach Hashem a few times already in Shoftim. Vititzlach Alav Ruach Hashem is something we're going to see with Shaul as well. And the Rambam understands it to be a low-level, non-conscious Nevuah. In other words, it is Hashem being manifest and boosting what a person is going to do, pushing a person to heights that they wouldn't have necessarily achieved, but along the lines of their natural tendencies. So that it's not that Shimshon is hearing a message saying, go do this, as much as he was motivated to do this anyway, it's just pushing him further. You know, there are times when there's something that you want to say or something that you want to do, but you hold back, and this is giving him a push, like, nah, go for it. The classic example that I always give for this is the one the Rambam brings in the Mora Nevuchim, where he talks about Moshe at the well and acting out in order to save the daughters of Yisro entirely against his better interest, because he's a fugitive running from Midian. But it's Moshe's fundamental inclination to go save the vulnerable from the people who are trying to harm them. Hashem is just pushing him a little further than he would have done on his own. That's the and that's what's going on here. It's not so much that a voice says to Shimshon, go do this, as Shimshon would have done this anyway, but Hashem is pushing him and sort of augmenting the drive to do it. That's the way that that I understand it. One other practical question here, or actually two other practical questions here. Number one is, what about impurity? Shimshon just killed 30 Plishtim. Granted that there's a debate in the Gemara about Tumas Ohel for non-Jews, meaning if a Jew is under the same roof as a body of someone who isn't Jewish, is impurity communicated? That's a basic machlokas. That's a basic debate. However, everybody agrees there's Tumas Maga. Everybody agrees that if he touches a dead body, he absolutely becomes Tameh. What happened to Shimshon? I thought he was supposed to be a Nazir. So this takes us back to a Gemara that we saw a while back in source number 3. Gemara in Nazir that in fact discusses the difference between a Nazir Shimshon, someone who says, I want to be a Nazir like Shimshon, and somebody who is going to be a normal Nazir, so to speak. He said, the Gemara in source number 3. Karban hu delamaisi avon nazirus chayla alei. It's commenting on a Mishnah. The Gemara quotes what the Mishnah says about a nazir Shimshon not bringing a karban. It's a longer discussion. We're going back into the Mishnah. The point is really the next piece. Mani masnisin. Who is the author of this Mishnah? And it says lo Rabbi Yehuda v'lo Rabbi Shimon. It's not Rabbi Yehuda. It's not Rabbi Shimon. And this is where my translation begins. Disanya, Brisa says, Rabbi Yehuda Omer Nazir Shimshon Mutter Li Tamei Lemesim. Rabbi Yehuda says, someone who says he's going to be a Nazir like Shimshon is allowed to become Tamei. Shakin Matzina B'Shimshon Shinitma, because Shimshon became Tamei. And Rabbi Shimon disagrees. And Rabbi Shimon says, it's not true. He says, there's no such thing as being a Nazir Shimshon. Shimshon wasn't a Nazir. And again, we talked about that, whether Shimshon really is a Nazir or not. He says Shimshon never took such a vow. And then the Gemara says, Mani. And then it wants to know, so who exactly is the author of our Mishnah? Dot, 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 dot. And now I jump to where I am in the translation, which is, if you're following in the Hebrew, in the Gemara quote, it's the next to last line. Uminalan di'itmi lemesim. How do you know Shimshon became Tamei for the dead? If it's from a story that we haven't seen yet, in chapter 15, where he says, I struck 1,000 men using the jawbone of a donkey. Dilma garuye gari behu velonagabu. No. Maybe what that means is simply that he threw the jawbone of the donkey at them and he killed 1,000 people by throwing this thing constantly. I hope it was a boomerang. That's how he did that. Maybe he didn't touch them. Elamei hacha. So he quotes our pasuk. Vayachmem shloshim ish vayikachas chalitzusam. He killed 30 men here and he took their clothing. So the Gemara says, Dilma shachinun bereshav ahadar katlinun. Maybe not. Maybe he removed the gear first, and then he killed them in some way that didn't involve direct contact, but he didn't take clothing off of dead bodies. So maybe that's how he did it. So they say no, because the pasuk says, Vayach. It says he struck them, and then Vayikach, and then he took it. So he said, well, maybe he was a ghost. Maybe they were ghosts of sin. Maybe they were dying, but they weren't quite dead. Trying to find different ways to show Shimshon didn't become Tamei. Before it concludes, fine, look, we have a tradition. He became Tamei. Enough. Shimshon, one way or another, whether you could prove it from the Pesukim or not, Shimshon becomes Tamei. However, even though the Gemara is happy with the idea that Shimshon, or not the Gemara, Rabbi Yehuda is comfortable with the idea that Shimshon became Tamei, Radak sees it necessary to bring two other explanations in source number 4. He gives a very interesting set of ideas. His first answer is sort of where the Gemara went. In source number 4, he says, maybe... Well, we can see it there. He says, Kiblu Raboseinu Zal Kimutur Hayaloli Tamei Lemesim Af Bishaya Nazir. Our rabbis have a tradition that Shimshon was allowed to become impure because even though he was a Nazir, nonetheless, it was a unique kind of being a Nazir. Velule Kabbalasam. But he says, if not for the Gemara's answer, if not for their tradition, I would have said, he hit the Plishtim with a stone. It's a stone, it's not a kli. And therefore, he doesn't become Tamei. The stone doesn't communicate impurity. Or, he says, Oh, Nuchalomar, Ki ayanizar milihi Tamei lemeis, Ela b'makom mitzvah. The answer is, he was careful not to become Tamei. V'amelchama b'plishtim mitzvah haisa. But the war against the Plishtim was actually a mitzvah. Laisa li'ilachim b'amelo shi'as Yisrael mi'adam. He's saving Israel. In other words, Radak says, this was a mitzvah war, and he says it's like the idea that a Nazir becomes Tamei for the sake of a mace mitzvah. If a Nazir is walking on the road and comes across a dead body, and the only one who can take care of the burial is the Nazir, so the Nazir does it. So he says if a Nazir will break being a Nazir in order to bury a dead body because of the mitzvah of doing that, so certainly Shimshon has a mitzvah of saving the Jews from the Plishtim. And that justifies it as well. So Radak is not, it does not rest with the Gemara's conclusion. The Gemara's answer is, Shimshon was either not a Nazir or a unique kind of Nazir such that he could become Tamei. And Radak says, no, either he didn't become Tamei or he became Tamei, but it was because he was saving the Jews. That was the justification. Okay. Clear? I ran through that a little bit, but is that clear?
Rabbi, can you just draw a parallel for us with Pinchas?
What do you mean?
Pinchas was a Kohen. Pinchas executed Zimri and the Midianite princess, just like Shimshon should have been dealing with the dead. Pinchas used the sword as opposed to a
mean, you could give a few different notes regarding Pinchas. First of all, the Gemara, without addressing the impurity issue, actually words it that he threw a spear at them. It's a romach in the text in the Torah, and a romach is a spear, it's not a sword. So the way that it's read in the Gemara is that he actually threw it, javelin-like, and therefore there's no contact. However, the simpler answer is the Medrash talks about whether Pinchas was a Kohen at all at that stage. And the understanding is that Pinchas is actually not a Kohen yet. He is made a Kohen after that. That's the whole discussion of Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon ha-Kohen. Who is the Kohen in that sentence? Is it Pinchas, son of Elazar, son of Aharon, who is a Kohen? Or is it Pinchas, who is the son of Elazar, who is the son of Aharon HaKohen? And the evidence for him not being a Kohen yet is that in the beginning of Parshas Pinchas, right after that, we're told, Hashem says, I'm going to give him and his children after him bris kihunas olam, the covenant of eternal kihuna. So the Medrash suggests that means he wasn't a Kohen yet at all. The other way to parse that sentence is that he was a Kohen, but his children would not have been Kohenim, and now they become Kohenim with bris kihunas olam. But it's certainly a legitimate read to say that Pinchas wasn't a Kohen at all, and therefore had no such restriction. You could give that that answer. So Shimshon kills the 30 plishtim. Again, perhaps because these are his wife's friends, that's why he's not killing them, and he still has feelings for her. Or alternatively, he wants to go deep into Plishti territory before he kills anybody. Those are our two suggestions. But whichever way you read it, he's not done with her. We saw the opening of Perek Tesvav, of chapter 15, and Pinchas thinks this relationship is still live. So why doesn't he have her with him? Why doesn't he stay with her? Why doesn't he take her home?
He's just upset with her at the moment.
Right, so the simple read would be, he's really mad. She told the secret, she betrayed him to the Plishtim, and he's livid, right? Later on, he's going to calm down, he's going to come back. He's Achashverosh with Vashti. Right, that kind of dynamic. I wouldn't compare Achashverosh to Shimshon, but you know what I'm saying. That's one way to look at it. But Professor Elitzur says not so fast. Go back to chapter 8, sentence 31, Perek Ches Pasuk Lamed Aleph. The end of Gideon's story. You see that?
Yeah.
What? How does that connect here? What you're seeing there? How does that shed light on what's going on here?
Which pasuk did you say?
Perek Ches Pasuk Lamed Aleph. If you look back at Pasuk Lamed there, that may help.
He had many wives.
No. Gideon had a whole bunch of wives. Ren Nashim Rabos Hayulo. And he had a Pilegesh in Shechem. Right?
Yeah.
In other words, the system was that people had a wife who was in their home, and then they would have a Pilegesh relationship, this concubine relationship, some kind of arrangement in which she wasn't even living in the house with him. She's in another city. Which, mind you, the Torah does not like, and the Gemara condemns explicitly, saying that, this can create all sorts of problems in terms of lineage issues. People may end up marrying their siblings without being aware of it. You don't want this to happen. But that was the state of things within society, was that you had a Pelegish in another town. So Professor Elitzur suggests that maybe what's going on here is Shimshon doesn't even think he's abandoning her. He thinks, okay, she's my wife here. Now I'm going to go back to be among the Jews, and eventually I'm going to come back to her. The father doesn't understand that, which is why he gives her away. The father thinks it's over. Shimshon doesn't think it's over. And that's why in the next perek, he comes back, he finds out she's gone, he's going to be angry about that, and then the Plishtim themselves are going to act against his former father-in-law, and he's going to be angry at them for doing that. Because Shimshon thinks this whole relationship is still ongoing.
Is it fair to use this as a rule of general application? Two reasons. Gidon had, what was it, 70 wives?
70 sons. We don't know how many wives.
Many wives. Shimshon didn't have any.
Right.
And the woman in the story with Gidon is a Pelegish.
Yes.
A lower status wife.
Correct.
So is this a case for applying a rule of general application as opposed to exception?
Unclear. Clearly, Professor Elitzur thinks that you can, and I think part of his deduction is based on the activities in chapter 15, where Shimshon clearly thinks the marriage has not ended. But no, it's not as though he's bringing you three or four data points to work from.
But you look, she has seven things on her Mishnah.
She's not a Pelegish in that sense. That seems fairly clear. Meaning he said, take her for me as a wife. He said, Isha. So I definitely don't think that she's being presented to us as a Pelegish. That said, the idea of a wife or quasi-wife in a different town is not such a leap. But yeah, I hear your point. The major point that I want to see here, meaning we've just taken the story and read it sentence by sentence and identified particular issues, but the major thematic issue here is Shimshon's deterioration. And here I want to play on something that I noted for you when we read it in the Psukim. Go back to Perek Yadalid, chapter 14, when they solve the riddle, Beterem Yavo Hacharsa, in sentence 18, before the sun sets. Is there significance to the Navi, the prophet, calling the sun Cheres here? Why didn't they say Beterem Yavo Hashemesh? Isn't that odd? We've seen the word Cheres before for sun. We saw at the end of Yehoshua and the start of Shoftim, the place where Yehoshua was buried was identified either as Timnat Serach or Timnat Cheres in different places, and we talked there about Cheres being a reference to the sun. In Eov, Cheres is also a reference to the sun. It comes up in a few different places in Tanakh. It's not unique to the case here. But they but why did you use Cheres instead of Shemesh? So I'll give you two answers. One answer is, I think, a little bit of a reach, and the other one I think is more substantive. But I'm going to give you the reach first. My great uncle, Professor Tur Sinai, was one of the leading Bible critics in the middle of the 20th century. He was a professor of Bible at Hebrew U. And he has an article on riddles and discusses the riddle of Shimshon. So in his article, he notes something interesting. Yehoshua was buried, I just mentioned, in a place called Timnat Cheres. Here in our story, you're finding Timna and Cheres. Now, he just says that and leaves it. But I wondered if you couldn't do something of substance with this. Because Yehoshua, and I put it in source number 5, got blamed for the Jews not conquering the land. And he dies early and is buried in Timnath Cheres early because of it. If you take a look at source number 5, Amru Rabbi Seinu, the rabbis have taught, Ksiv b'Yoshua kasher ha'isi Moshe ahiyah imach. Hashem told Yoshua, I'm going to be with you the way I was with Moshe. Vayetzarech Yoshua lechias kuf chavshana kemoshe Rabbeinu. So Yoshua should have lived to be 120 years old. V'laman iskatz rishnos of yud shanim. Why does Yoshua lose 10 years? Because when Hashem told Moshe, we read it last week, right? They should punish Midian for what they had done, and then he's going to die. Moshe knew he's going to die after this war, and yet he did not delay. Elin is dareis. Vayishlachosam Moshe. He was energetic. He did it. Aval Yoshua. But Yoshua, Kevin Shabali Hilachim im Lamed Aleph Malachim, Omar, Emani or Gam Miyad, Miyad and Imeis, Kishem Shahasim Moshe Rabbeinu. Yoshua has to go fight 31 kings. He says, if I fight them, I'm going to die. I don't want to die. So what did he do? Hischel Ma'akev Bimelchamtam. He took his time. As the Pasuk says, Yamim Rabim Asa Yoshua, Skolam Lachim Ayala Milchama. He did this, he waged this war for a long time. Omar Lo Akadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says to him, the kachas isa, that's what you do. Harina mekatzer shnosecha yud shanim. He says, I'm knocking 10 years off your life. So there. There's a longer discussion about how we know that Yoshua stalled. Is this really sufficient as evidence that Yoshua was stalling? I don't think it's only based on this. If you take a second, I'll just show you one piece of evidence to support the idea. If you go back to chapter 2 in Shoftim, sentences 20 and 21. Perek Bet, Pesukim Chav Chav Aleph. This is the criticism of the Jews for failing in their mission. So Hashem says in Pasuk Chav, this nation broke the covenant that I commanded their ancestors. They didn't listen to my voice. Hashem says, I'm not going to conquer anyone before them. From the nations Yoshua left there, and he died. So I think the Medrash is picking up on that. That's a very odd turn of phrase. Right? Hashem says, I'm not going to conquer any of those who Yoshua left alive and he died. It's a link of, he left them alive, therefore he died. And so the Medrash here is saying, Yoshua is to blame for not settling the land. And so I wonder now, picking up again on this idea that Yoshua's death and burial, Timnath Cheres, is linked with Shimshon's decline here, I wonder if blame for Shimshon's involvement with the Plishti woman is being laid on Yahushua's doorstep. This is his legacy. He didn't fight the wars he was supposed to fight, and this is what happened as a result.
What's the connection, though?
So, this is a pretty oblique reference. This is what I said when I said it's a reach. Just the fact that Timnath Cheres makes it into our story. It's in Timnata, and the sun here is called Cheres instead of Shemesh, in order to link it to Yoshua's burial, which is associated with the fact that he didn't defeat the Plishtim. Or not the Plishtim, it's the Canaanim that he was supposed to defeat. Like I said, it's a reach, but I thought it was interesting. The more substantive answer for why it's called Cheres here comes from Rabbi Bechhofer's work, The Big Day Sheish. He says, what does Cheres mean when it doesn't mean sun?
Clay.
It's a shard.
Clay or
it's a pottery shard. Right?
Disease.
So it's not a disease as much as it's a, well, it depends on which cheres you mean. Do you mean Eo's cheres that he uses to scratch at his skin, or do you mean when the skin becomes rough like cheres? That's what you're...
I'm quoting Safari as opposed to coming up with something myself, where okay. It defines it as a disease.
Okay.
As well as the sun. They probably are referencing Eof, yes.
But Eof scratches at his skin with cheres, but there is the idea of skin becoming rough when with some kind of illness. It's true. But I think what's going on over here, and Bechaver's point I think is accurate, is Shimshon is identified with the sun. We talked about that with his original naming as Shimshon. And what you're doing now is saying he's not the sun, he's a broken shard. Shimshon is the one who's being knocked by naming the sun Cheres. It's highlighting Shimshon's deterioration. But there's more to the deterioration. He calls his wife here Eglati, my calf. Why does he choose that term, the calf? So you could say that it's actually driven by the verb. What he wants to say is, charashtem, you plowed, because the term lachrosh is not only a term for plowing, it's also a term that is used for espionage. When the meraglim go, into the land, they are sent in cheresh, they are sent in to act as silent secret spies. So he wants to say, you were choresh. And he's making a pun. Once he says Choresh, he wants to make a pun with Eglati. And that's one possible way to look at it. I also noted last time, Ralbag says Lachrosh is also potentially an allegation of infidelity. But there's more to this image than just the plowing part of Choresh. What is an Egla in Tanakh? Yes, but what does it symbolize?
The disobedient.
Okay. So an egala. The egala zahav we'll get to. That's a male, but yes. Sorry? David, you're frozen. I'm not here.
I'm saying a disobedient.
Right, so that's a piece of it. So the egla is a beloved creature in Tanakh. In Shmuel Bet Perek Gimel, we're introduced to a wife of David who is named Egla. And the Gemara is bothered because it doesn't know of any wife of David named Egla. We know the names of David's wives. None of them are named Egla. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin, in source number 7, says the Egla is a reference to Michal. And she's called an Egla because she was chavivalav. She was beloved to him like a calf. In Hosea, and I gave you the reference in source number 6, in Hosea, Ephraim is called Hashem's Egla. And Ephraim is beloved to Hashem. Haben Yakir Li Ephraim. Ephraim is beloved to Hashem. The Egla is a beloved creature. However, it also needs taming, which is the story of David's relationship with Michal. And of course, you know where that goes, where Michal criticizes David and gets in trouble for doing so. And the Egla in Hosea needs to learn the yoke. There's a relationship in which the Egla is beloved, and I'm not here recommending anything in terms of relationships with one's spouse. Please take this, under advisement. But the disclaimers are needed. But the idea here is that the Egla is beloved, but unruly. And I wonder if this is a case of what the Gemara calls Nibei, Velo Yada Ma Nibei. Someone who prophesies and doesn't realize that they are prophesying. It's an expression that the Medrash uses regarding Avraham at the Akedah, when Avraham says to the two who have accompanied them, he says, he says, the youth and I are going to go bow. We're going to go over there. We're going to bow. And then we will come back to you. So the Medrash says, aha, he had a prophecy and he didn't even realize it. Similarly with Lavan, when Lavan gives the bracha to Rivka that your descendants should conquer the gate of their enemies, also it's a nevuah that he doesn't even understand. And maybe Shimshon is doing that as well, because the Eglah in Tanakh symbolizes a brit. Eglah symbolizes a covenant. Where do we see an Eglah with a covenant?
Avraham,
right. Eglam Mishuleshet. Bris Ben Absarim. Exactly. But on the other end, it's also the breaking of a covenant at the golden calf. So again, I don't want to lose everybody here by running through this too quickly. But what we're seeing here, potentially, is a powerful image. The idea of the calf could simply be that he wants to use the term lachrosh, espionage, so he throws in the calf, because it fits. It could be because the Eglah is a beloved creature, and she was beloved to him. But it could also be that he's unknowingly alluding to, his relationship with the Plishtim. He's playing a dangerous game. She could be your Brit with Hashem, and she could be your Egel. It can go both ways. But what's fascinating to me in all of this, or most fascinating in all of this, because a lot here is fascinating, but what's most fascinating here is that all of this is happening. His marriage to the Plishti woman, going to the party, getting in the fight, everything else, alongside Ruach Hashem. Even though he's way out on a limb here. Doesn't matter. Hashem is still with him. Hashem is strengthening him to go ahead and act. First of all, important note, going back to something we said ages ago when we introduced Shimshon, the strength is not coming from his hair. The strength is coming from Ruach Hashem. Without the Ruach Hashem, he's got nothing. So that's number one. But number two, whatever Shimshon is doing wrong, Hashem is still supporting him. His actions still fit the divine plan, and Shimshon is going to continue to believe that Hashem is on his side. And that, to me, is one of the most important points in the entire story of Shimshon, is the way he believes every step of the way that God is always going to be there for him. Whatever crazy thing he's gotten himself involved in, doesn't make a difference, Hashem is going to be there for me. So to summarize what we've seen in this story, Shimshon goes after this Plishti woman for reasons that are unclear. We don't know if he thought he was doing the right thing. We don't know if she converted. We do know his parents are unhappy. That was loud and clear. Hashem sends Shimshon a message reinforcing his strength with this lion as he defeats the lion. And the bees are there as well to enable the riddle that is going to cause strife with the Plishtim. He does the riddle, whether it's to punish them because they didn't come greet him, or whether it's just for fun and that was what people did. And they undermine him using his Plishti wife, who is awful. She's more loyal to them than she is with him, as opposed to his mother. Remember, we talked about contrasting the Plishti women with Shimshon's mother. And Shimshon keeps on going, thinking that Hashem is on his side. That's what emerges from our perek. Was this somewhat clear? I rushed a little bit in order to get to the end of the perek. I hope it's okay. So, God willing, at the end of August, we will resume here on Zoom, and no pun intended, and 7:30 or 8 o'clock, we'll see, but on August 25th, I hope. All right?
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And yeah, Fred will be back in your house before you know it.
God willing.
All right. Enjoy your break. Thank you.
Later,
you too.
Everybody.